Welcome to Common Air, your guide to arts and culture in St. John and beyond. It rose out of me like a beast that could not be contained. Any sense of calm I had previously experienced was extinguished by the burning rage that extended from the tips of my toes to the tip of the invisible string that pulled my head up straight to create perfect posture. These feelings could not be right. I must be doing something wrong. Why was I suddenly possessed by a yoga beast? It had all been my mother's idea. She had a friend who was teaching a 6-week introduction to yoga class and suggested we try the class out together. Having nothing better to do on a Wednesday evening, and liking the idea of becoming a svelte reed that could gracefully move with the blowing of the winds, I agreed to join my mom in the yoga class. I should have dropped out and left immediately. Something was not right from the beginning. While everyone else in the class could gracefully transition from one pose to the next, my body felt clunky and rebelled at the notion of poses like a downward dog. As class continued, I became more stressed, and then frustrated, and then angry. My personality changed, and I became a yoga hulk. I haven't been back to a yoga studio since my negative yoga hulk experience. Until I decided to step back into one and try to figure out why I became possessed by a yoga beast, if that was normal, natural, or if I just really was doing something wrong. To find these answers, I visited St. John's own yoga co-op. As soon as I stepped into the first class, I knew this was different. The space was inviting. Just a big open room. Sarah, our instructor, was inviting and friendly. Gone were all the girls in their Lululemon pants, giving every girl in the room the eye scan to see if they thought they belonged in the yoga class. At Yoga Co-op, everyone belonged. It had a real sense of community. At the end of the yoga class, I sat down with Sarah to discuss the history of the Yoga Co-op, how she got interested in yoga, and to see if she had any advice for how I could tame my yoga beast. Can you tell me the story of how the Yoga Co-op started?
Almost 2 years ago, so about a year and a half, we had a call, myself and Jill Roach, who we opened the co-op together, had a call from some students who were looking for yoga uptown because recently a studio had closed and so they felt they had nowhere to go. So then we decided to open up a co-op, and in June of 2011, yes, is that a year and a half ago? Yeah. And so we started in June, just the two of us teaching, and then come September, we added another teacher, and then we added another teacher, and then we... So now we're up to 6 teachers, and we have classes 5 days a week, and multiple classes on some days, so...
What do you think makes the Yoga Co-op different from other yoga studios?
I think it's our sense of community. We really cherish our students. They come in through the door, and as a co-op, our teachers all have a say in scheduling, in, you know, class cancellations, in everything that goes on in the space, but our students also do. So when we're putting up a schedule or we're thinking of changing something about the studio, we send that out to our students first so that they have a say in what happens in the space. And we have a few students who actually made, like, the bolsters we're sitting on. Mm-hmm. We have a student who made those, her and I, we made them together, and it's really great. Whenever a new teacher would come in, we'd have students that would say, oh, I'll show you where things are. Like, so our students really take pride and ownership in the space, as well as our teachers. Everyone kind of plays an integral role in keeping the space running and going, I think that makes our space a little bit different than other studios, maybe, that that we're definitely a community space, that people come and share things with each other. And
I was wondering, too, if you could tell me your sort of personal yoga story, how you found yoga and why you still do yoga.
Well, I am a dancer, and I started dancing when I was 3, and I went away to Toronto and studied and danced professionally and taught dance. And I found that with dancing, I was, you know, I had injuries and things like that, so I saw a specialist for it, but I needed something else other than dance. And at that time, I never, you know, I didn't go to a gym or anything. I was a starving student artist, and I didn't have that kind of money. So then, you know, friends said, oh, well, I go to yoga, and you can go to these community classes. They're only $5, or you can, you know, kind of work at the studio, like wash mats and stuff and take yoga for free. So I was like, I'm getting in on that. So, yeah, so I started taking yoga, and I just found that it was the perfect balance for me with dancing and doing that, and I found my body really, really benefited from a regular yoga practice. So while I was still living in Toronto, I kind of sought out a way to learn how to teach it, because I thought this would be a really great tool for me to have, that I teach dance, I dance, but teaching yoga would be a great, you know, sort of another job that I could have that could help supplement my income. So I found this school called Satiram, and basically it's like I have a guru, and I would go see her once a month, but it was up to me to do all of my own teaching. I mean, like self-teaching. So I had, you know, my physiology, philosophy of yoga, history of yoga, and I had to, it was a self-study. So I studied everything on my own, and then I would be tested on it through her. And then in terms of the practice, I had to go and take class around the city, which was kind of great, because then that way I was able to take class with lots of different teachers and lots of different styles. And it was a way to figure out what style was best for me and what I would like to teach. So rather than learning a specific style of yoga, I learned various styles to figure out how I wanted to teach yoga. So, yeah.
And which style do you mostly focus on?
It seems that I focus more on Hatha yoga, though I do put in Ashtanga things. And in a vinyasa class, I would teach more Ashtanga paced things, but I still come back to Hatha. It's kind of the base, I feel, for yoga. But then I love restorative and yin yoga, so
You still kind of like to
teach. Yeah, and then I teach intro too, so I teach beginners. So I kind of go all over the place, and I like it all. I like the variety of it, because it I don't ever get bored. I can teach a really quick pace class, or I can teach a really gentle, slow-moving introductory class, or restorative, and yeah.
Did you ever have, sort of, to take an Oprah phrase, an aha moment, a yoga aha moment, where you were like, yes, this is why I love this, or you did a certain pose, and you were just like, oh yeah, I kind of feel more enlightened, or...
Yeah. Definitely. When I was practicing like every day, when I was living in Toronto, I was practicing every day, and sometimes 2-3 classes a day, because I had to get a certain amount of hours. So I had to like 500 hours or something crazy. And so through that, I found like your body just becomes so in touch with itself that I just, like, there were a lot of moments where I was like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. And the one of the biggest benefits I feel from yoga is that I learned about anatomy. I took anatomy in dance school, but it didn't sink in. And so physically being in the yoga studio and having really great teachers talk about anatomical focuses and injuries, I was able to learn about my injury and figure out, oh, this is why I'm injured, and this is what causes it, and this is how I can not be injured again. And so and then in teaching yoga too, I mean, when you get a student who, say, you know, has an injury or is not flexible or, you know, basically can't move, you have to really think on your feet to how is that person going to benefit from yoga without doing all of the moves that I would typically do. So you're always coming back to square one with it, or back to the sort of the building blocks of yoga, which I think is just so important. And that's why I always recommend that as a teacher, it's really important to teach those introductory courses, because you're going to learn so much more, not only about your students, but about your own self and your own limitations.
After talking with Sarah for a good 10-15 minutes, I felt comfortable enough to bring up my yoga beast question. I explained how I had previously been to yoga classes, and how I got frustrated, and that my frustration then turned to anger, and that whenever I left a yoga class, I wanted to punch things. And I was wondering if she had some advice on why that might happen, and if there's any way to still do yoga without becoming a yoga hulk.
Well, I have not encountered anger per se, though I actually know, now that I think about it, I have had a student here one time that she finished class and I could tell she was just really kind of agitated. And she didn't talk about it, but I was like, whoa, I can really sense, you know, like everyone else is kind of walking around like they're on a cloud, you know, like, la, 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 we just had Shavasana, I feel great. And she was just really, like, just angry or, like, agitated was the word. And she left really quickly. And she was a person that, you know, would often sit and talk and, you know, and was really relaxed. But then I had another case, not angry, but someone who actually we were in a pose and they started crying. And so we have energy in our body and we have chakras that line the center of our body, if that's something that we believe in or whatever. And sometimes if those chakras are overworked or underworked, in yoga there are poses that are designed to open or to strengthen those chakras. And so if a chakra has been maybe underworked, like this was what was happening with this woman, we were in a pose that was kind of like a heart opener. And it was a very deep heart opener. And I didn't say anything to anyone, but all of a sudden she just started crying. And no one saw her because they had their heads under, and so no one saw what was going on. But after she came up to me and she said, that's never happened to me before, but I felt like my heart was just, my heart opened and I just couldn't stop crying. So, and there's other poses that I've had other teachers say, like, you know, this is a really emotional posture. So if you start to feel a little agitated or sad or, you know, and so, I mean, our physical body is connected to our mental body. So it, to me, it just makes sense that if something's going on in my brain, but I haven't, it hasn't registered yet, it could potentially come out in my body. So if I'm doing a posture that that targets that chakra and it targets that emotional center, then I may cry or I may swear or get angry or agitate, you know, like, so that's kind of my thought on it, is that it is connected and, yeah, there's maybe something going on and it could just be on an energetic level that, you know, we're not balanced and so there's something kind of just a little bit out of whack. Doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with us. We're human, so it just means about, you know, just kind of balancing that out, and then hopefully next time it doesn't happen.
Is there, if someone was experiencing that, or let's, the class is over, because it was always like building,
yep.
And then the class is over, it was like Hulk mode.
Mm.
Is there a way to, like, oh, I recognize I'm really angry, what do I do? Other than yell at someone.
Right, yes, yeah. I mean, then it would be a matter we could do like some research into looking into like, okay, well, where is that anger coming from within your body? Do you feel it in your chest? Do you feel it in your belly? Do you feel it, you know, like where in the body is it coming from? And then looking at, okay, well, what poses in yoga help to maybe open that area or strengthen it, or, you know, so then you might do a couple of poses to sort of help with that, and sometimes just sitting and breathing and not talking to anyone it can be helpful too, just to sort of like quiet your mind and quiet the body a little bit and quiet that center that kind of got ruptured or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
are the chakras, like, for anyone who doesn't really know what they are, and I only have like a kind of like really outlined idea, are they certain chakras attached to certain kind of emotions, or are they more attached to certain areas of your body?
Both. So we have 7 chakras that start at the root, at the pelvic floor, and they go all the way up to the crown of our head. And they're attached to like a earth, water, fire symbol. They have a little chant that goes with them. They also, they're definitely attached to the physical location of that, of where they are, and as well as the emotional. Yeah. And then our, like our root chakra is what, how it sounds. Like it's the root, it's the bottom of our body. It's attached to family and, you know, our roots. Yeah. So, and it just moves up. And so in our heart is, you know, attached to our, love and compassion and empathy and simply, you know, and so it's, yeah, so.
I'm happy to report that I had no yoga anger or visitations from the yoga beast while I did yoga at the yoga co-op. But I'm still just slowly bringing yoga back into my routine, so I think I'll practice at home just to keep the community safe until I know that the yoga beast has truly been silenced. I'd like to thank Sarah for taking the time to speak with me and to tell me the story of the yoga co-op. If you're interested in taking classes at the yoga co-op, you can visit their webpage at yogacoop.ca. There's a schedule and list of all the different classes that they offer there. And I can truly say, it's a great space. You're listening to Common Air. Next up, we have a new truth versus fiction story that has come to us from Tom in Fredericton. And now for the story, Dwayne.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom O'Connell, and this is my story titled Dwayne. When I was in university, I had a summer job here in St. John working at the St. John Harbor Bridge. Now, I wasn't one of the people in the toll booths. That's always the first question I get when I say that. My job was I worked on a crew with a couple other guys just doing general maintenance work, things like putting up pylons for construction, painting, cleaning the toll area. And if anyone's ever had a job like that in the summer, like general maintenance, whether you're working for the city or another company, you know that there's a lot of downtime. And our job was certainly no exception to that. And also, if you're all in any way familiar with St. John, you know that the Harbor Bridge is right by the harbor. It's obviously a very aptly named bridge. And if you're anywhere near the harbor, you know that you're bound to come into contact with a seagull at some point. And that's what happened to us. On top of our garage, there were probably about half a dozen seagull nests. So about mid to late July, seagull eggs would open and little baby seagulls would come out, and there'd be a little pitter-patter of baby seagull feet on our roof. At first it was cute, but then it kind of got annoying. And then one day, one of the baby seagulls fell off the roof. He must have just walked off the side. And he was kind of walking around a parking lot, dazed. Maybe he had some sort of concussion, I don't know. But we all felt bad for this little guy. So we gave him food, got a little thing to put water in for him. And I don't know who it was, but one of us named him Dwayne. Because, you know, no human interaction with an animal, emotional connection with an animal is complete without giving the animal a name. So that's what we did. But anyway, Dwayne became a bit like our mascot. You know, he'd always be around. If we were doing a job, Wayne would just kind of pop up and watch. And we realized that if we tried to get close to Dwayne, he would run away and flap his wings. That's why we never really found out whether it was male or female. We never got close for that. Nor did we have the desire to, because really, who would? But if we got close to Dwayne, he would run and flap his wings. The other seagulls had just kind of written him off. I guess they're like, well, he's screwed. They knew a lost cause when they saw one, I guess. But we did not. And in fact, I think it was my idea. I'm not very proud of it, but it was my idea that if we ran at the seagull and he ran and flapped his wings enough, he would eventually learn to fly. That was my brilliant contribution to this situation. It made sense at the time, and for a little while, it actually worked. So I would just like maybe just slowly approach Dwayne, and he would jump, flap his wings, and slowly, like a helicopter, like glide back down to the earth. And I really thought, like, I'm actually teaching this wild animal to fly, to survive in the wild. And I felt like I'd really accomplished something. Clearly, I wasn't doing any, accomplishing any work, but that's beside the point. And as weeks went on, about 2 or 3 weeks passed, and every day I did this. I'd see the seagull, I'd run at it. Didn't matter if I was in the middle of a conversation or I was in the middle of mowing a lawn. I would just leave the lawnmower and I'd run at the seagull. And every time I did it, the seagull would glide further and further. And then one day. Well, let me put it this way. If you're familiar with this area at all, you know that transport trucks come by a lot. And one day a transport truck was coming out of the port area carrying a big trailer full of cars going to a car dealership. And Dwayne was sitting right by where the transport trucks came out. And the whole crew was there, and we all stopped what we're doing. And it must have looked insane, because we just stopped there, reach our arms out, and go, no! And the driver sees us, sees the seagull, slams on his brakes, and slowly maneuvers around the seagull, who was not moving. And one of the other guys I work with thought, well, if I go around the other side of Dwayne and chase him back to where he came from, he'll come back to us, because we are clearly his family now. He'll feel safe. He won't get run over. So he goes to do that. And for a second it works. Dwayne's like kind of glides towards us, but then he takes a hard left and flaps his wings once and levitates off the air a little bit. Flaps his wings a second time, levitates off the ground a little bit more. It very quickly becomes clear that my goal had been reached. Dwayne was legitimately flying. And he was flying towards the highway, taking with each movement of his wings, he was going higher and higher. It was a great moment. I really felt like, you know, we saved the seagull. until he flew directly in front of the toll plaza, directly in front of a transport truck, and at which point he immediately exploded into a ball of feathers and guts and blood. In trying to save poor Dwayne, we ended up pushing him right towards his demise. The irony was not lost on any of us. We just kind of stood there, open-mouthed, gaping, not entirely sure how to react, whether we should be sad or just laugh. And this is a great thing about this story when I tell it to people. I work as a teacher, a substitute teacher, and sometimes a kid asks me, "Mr. O'Connell, I don't understand irony. Can you explain it to me?" And I say, "Oh boy, do I have the story for you." And that's the story of Dwayne.
Thanks, Tom, for sharing your story with Truth Versus Fiction and Common Air. If you have a story you would like to share, you can email kim@cfmh.ca. You've been listening to Common Air. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to get involved with the show, you can visit commonair.org. Thanks for listening.